The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. On this week's program, we're looking back on the past 14 days of politics and the uncomfortable love triangle that's been unfolding between the three main party leaders. Who knows, by the end of today, we may even have a winner. Their allegiances are flipping faster than the MP's housing market, and we've been watching it all on the web. So, to what extent has the UK general election of 2010 been a digital election? We'll be finding out. Joining me to discuss this and the latest technology news are The Guardian's new media correspondent, Jemima Kish, and Matthew McGregor from Blue State Digital, the team that orchestrated the Obama new media campaign. Welcome to you both. Jemima, what was your favourite new media moment of the election?
Well, Cash Gordon was obviously a highlight when the Tories used some ill-advised off-the-shelf campaigning tool. But also, I think, watching the debates and then reading the feedback, the back channel on Twitter, not because, being honest, there was any serious political analysis on there, but just because it was really funny.
What I did find is there were a couple of days when I wasn't able to watch the debates, and it almost spoiled it for me by reading what was happening on the Twitter back channel. So, you know, it was nice to catch up, sort of like DVD extra, to actually watch the
the
debate.
That's just it, DVD extra. That's what it is.
Matthew, what was your favourite new media moment?
I was a big fan of the Twitter humour that was pretty pervasive through the campaign. Actually, my favourite moment was just after the campaign, the Liberal Conservative Policies hashtag of introducing the euro but only in Tyneside, ID cards but only for people who shop in Sainsbury's, and those. I thought it was also very interesting that Gordon Brown used email to apologise to Labour supporters for Bigotgate, as the hashtag was immediately sprung up. And I thought that was an interesting moment too.
Really a big Twitter election, which I think, you know, emphasises the interesting aspects of Twitter, that it really is it's an event-driven technology. But we can talk about that later. We'll also have a dispatch from the front line of online crime. Charles Arthur reports. Finally, in the week that the Apple iPad's UK pricing plan was unveiled, we take a look at one of their most persuasive competitors, the Juju tablet. Keep listening for the latest on these stories and the rest of this week's technology news here on Tech Weekly. First, this year's general election in the UK was dubbed the digital election as the politicians and their machines began to whir into action in March. But now that the dust has almost settled and our participation is no longer required, we can assess whether this was something dreamed up by the old and new medias. Some of our listeners, like Emma Bedford, believe that it was. She says, "I found my Labour candidate on Twitter, invited him over for a cuppa, impressed me, campaigned for him. Is that digital enough?" Others, however, weren't so convinced about the digital election. Gareth Spence comments, "I don't believe that it was, especially from the leaders' perspectives. Not one of them embraced any form of real digital outreach." But most of our listeners believe that it was a digital first. North 5 sums up the majority of the responses. He says, "Following the election and deciding how to vote was exclusively digital. The actual politicians, not so much." So, Matthew, I'd like to turn to you first and talk a little bit more about this digital election phenomenon. You're the London director of Blue State Digital, the team behind MyBarackObama.com, and you yourself have over 10 years of creating digital campaigns. What was digital really about the UK's election this year?
Well, there are two ways to look at digital. The first one is about the information and access to information, a two-way conversation online between politicians and the public, but also the media as well. And in that sense, the election was very digital. The role of Twitter and YouTube had a big impact on the news cycles, speeding them up, giving access to people directly to politicians, but also directly to journalists. Lots of people were following journalists directly, and towards the end, actually, some people were even following the camera crews from the different TV broadcasters. So in that sense, the direct communication between what has traditionally been quite a closed bubble and the public was pretty open. But I think you have to ask yourself, what impact does that have on the votes cast? And in what way does that impact on elections as the results come out? And actually, I think the lesson from the US election, Barack Obama's phenomenal internet campaign, was that the internet can be used to mobilise supporters, to mobilise enthusiasts and get them to do very traditional things. What was successful about Barack Obama's campaign was not that he built an email list of 13 million people, but he communicated with those 13 million people in a way that got them to knock on hundreds of thousands of doors, make millions of phone calls, and speak to people. And I think that kind of word-of-mouth campaigning, using new media tools, but being quite traditional in the end result, is what is really interesting and exciting to me about the internet. And I don't think that was particularly big in this election.
Do you think perhaps that may have been because of the time limit? You know, in this country we have 5 weeks or you know, something very, very small versus... You know, the Obama campaign, the Clinton campaign, what was happening in the US was over the space of a year. So it's almost like it's a slow build, isn't it?
Well, people say that, you know, the short campaign when people get really excited about politics or quite excited maybe about politics is 4 months. But we've known there was going to be an election. Like, everybody knew there was going to be an election at some point, and the time was there to build people's enthusiasm. And in elections, the people you're really trying to get to engage at the last moment, and they're the people you need the advocates to communicate with. But the parties could have done more over the course of a year to build a relationship with their supporters that would have meant that when there was a moment in the campaign, like the Lib Dems had with the TV debate, that they could go pop and get their activists out on the streets, and they didn't do that.
Jemima, you mentioned My Society and how My Society's Tom Steinberg says that the important work is done between the elections, and this is certainly what you're suggesting, Matthew, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the money shot is the vote, you know, and that's what the parties really need. But longer term, and thinking about much more than a sort of 4-year election cycle, is real daily life and how the internet can properly empower people and communities and local communities and get people engaged with local issues and things that really matter to them. My Society has a spin-off project called Democracy Club, which has been asking people to get involved with monitoring what each of the candidates have been doing in every area across the country. And they've got more than 6,000 volunteers to lobby each of those candidates and put forward a questionnaire of what they think on key issues. It's a way of holding those people to account, and it looks much further than just an election cycle.
Matthew, taking a backwards look at what happened in this election, where do you think the campaigns got it right?
I think the parties have all of them have examples of good practice. I think all of them have got good tools on their websites. The Labour Party's phone bank tool that allowed supporters to make calls into marginal constituencies and be a volunteer advocate for the party, which actually, interestingly, was taken up by people outside the party, Labour bloggers and tweeters, and pushed by them, not by the party centrally. I thought that was very interesting. The Conservative Party allowing people outside the party, whether they're members or not, to use the myconservatives.com function and watch videos and donate to candidates. The Lib Dems started to use email in a good way. I think those are quite isolated examples of something that pointed towards a quite hopeful next election, maybe, but in this election didn't really make the material difference between the results they would have had and the results they could have had.
What would you say that they got wrong? Because this perhaps is something that's a little bit more key.
I think if you take a step back and look at the approach to using new media to campaign, I think on the whole, the parties too much think of new media as being a means to communicate with undecided voters and to persuade people who are not decided by providing them content and video that will explain the policies and get them signed up. I actually think that tweets and Facebook pages and YouTube videos aren't what wins elections. I think that people speaking to their friends and their neighbours and their work colleagues and advocating for the policies of a particular party and how it affects them, that's what wins elections. And so I think the parties need to refocus their new media offer on their activists and connecting their activists online to campaign offline.
I think one of the dangers, though, associated with this campaign was the idea that you could pick up a lot of the tools, a lot of the strategies from the US election, which everybody did call a digital media election, and simply plop it over here. And I'm wondering where there are areas where that simply didn't work, where the cookie cutter digital strategy from the US or even from the Australian campaigns just simply don't work in this country. And can you give me some insight as to where that might be?
I think where that happened was it was an over-focus on the fact that Barack Obama had a very heavy Twitter following or lots of YouTube videos and seeing that one area and thinking if we transplant that here, the rest will follow. And it's actually, you know, Barack Obama was so successful because he was a community organizer and understood the nature of empowerment. it wasn't that he was good at making YouTube videos. So I think it's important the parties take a step back and look at the philosophy of this thing rather than individual gimmicks or tools.
My sense really is that Facebook and Twitter and other social media doesn't create these behaviours in people. It reflects people's opinions, and it reflects what is happening in the real world and what is happening in politics. And although there are some really strong trends in Twitter, it's very powerful for information sharing, very fast, as you said earlier, Matthew. It's also quite useful for giving people that that maybe need it, if that's a tactful way of talking about politicians, look like they have a personality. You know, it makes them able to directly talk to people in a way that they haven't really been able to do before, because all other media, TV, for example, they don't know who they're talking to. But there is also a heavy liberal bias to Twitter and to Facebook, which, particularly in the case of the Liberal Democrats, quite clearly did not translate into votes. And that, you know, these people maybe didn't make it to the polls, or they were the people queuing at 10 o'clock. I don't know. It didn't happen, did it?
So overall, Matthew, would you say that it was a digital election? Because, you know, there was swathes and swathes of people who simply weren't using these tools. I mean, Rory Kathleen Jones says the internet, from social media to Google to good old-fashioned news websites, did play a significant part in the way many people experienced this election. Is that not just a focus on his community, on the people that he knows, the communities that he interacts with?
I don't think the internet was a decisive factor in the campaign in this election, but I think the lessons that the parties learned and outside organisations learned means that it could well be the last time we'll say that. I think there are campaign groups outside of the parties where there are lessons to be learned. A group we work with, Hope Not Hate, the campaign against the BNP, 140,000 people on an email list, but translating that into tens of thousands of pounds in campaign funds and hundreds of people in Barking and Dagenham, where the BNP were wiped out from the council, which was a great result for that campaign. And I think there's some lessons to be learned there. And maybe in the same way that in the States, Howard Dean blazed a trail without being entirely successful, organisations like Hope Not Hate and others post-election, like the campaign groups that organised the flash mobs outside the Lib Dems headquarters, a group we work with, Take Back Parliament, they're blazing a trail that parties can learn from, and I think they need to pick those lessons up. And that means that next time, the internet could be a decisive factor in a way it hasn't been this time.
Well, we look forward to watching the space. Thank you very much, Matthew, for coming in. The Apple iPad may be grabbing all the headlines this week, but there's another tablet on the market. The Linux-based Juju tablet, designed specifically for web surfing on the go. Originally called the Crunch Pad, this machine was the pet project of TechCrunch's Michael Arrington, who hoped to collaboratively design an open-sourced gadget that would cost less than $200. However, in November last year, the project was shelved by Arrington, and the hardware developers, Singapore-based Fusion Garage, announced that they would be releasing the Juju tablet instead. Since then, Arrington and Fusion Garage have fallen out spectacularly. The lawsuits are only the beginning. Charles Arthur met with Fusion Garage CEO Chandra Radhakrishnan, who began their conversation by playing down comparisons with other tablet devices.
We've not launched a tablet computer. We have launched a Juju, which is a web-based device that allows you to surf the web in its absolute glory. So you can have everything you do from Flash to the web services in a device that has a form factor that allows you to enjoy laid-back content. So what we call couch computing.
I've got one here in front of me. It's larger than an iPad. It's a 12.1-inch screen, which is, you say, is the largest in the industry at the moment.
That's right. It's the largest in the industry. It's the largest multi-touch screen, 30% bigger than the iPad.
What is the what's the operating system that this runs on? Because it doesn't look like anything I've seen before.
Yeah, Juju runs its own operating system called the Juju operating system. It's a web-based or browser-based operating system that takes the Linux kernel and combines it with WebKit to just go into the browser straight away. Although we call it a browser operating system, the visualization of it is not quite representative of the browsers that you see today. So the UI is very different, the experience is very different, but essentially it's a browser.
So it's a Linux kernel and WebKit running effectively to do all the interaction on top of that.
That's right. It's completely rendered in HTML.
How long did this take to develop?
The device has been in the works since February 2008. Fusion Garage were founded in February 2008 with the express intention of creating a browser operating system.
Now, there's a big dispute about this, surely, in the US, because Mike Arrington of TechCrunch was the guy who was calling this the crunch pad up until until the sort of autumn of last year, when suddenly it became the Juju, and I think the Ritz began to fly.
We started working on this in February 2008.
At Mike Arrington's urging?
No. The company was founded without Michael Arrington's involvement. The company was founded in Singapore by me and started in February 2008 with the intention of creating a browser operating system. Michael Arrington then wrote a blog post in July 2008 suggesting that he wanted the community to help him build a web tablet for $200. To cut the long story short, he wanted to acquire Fusion Garage when we first met him because of the fact that we had done everything that he thought the world should be with the operating system we had. That acquisition discussions went on for a year. We continued developing what we were developing, and we just couldn't agree on terms. We decided to offer different terms eventually to still have him involved, but he rejected the terms in the most disappointing fashion.
He seemed to be very convinced that he had a lot of intellectual property in this.
If someone has, we can tell you categorically that we own all the intellectual property, and it must say something to say that we're the only ones outside, out in the market with the product.
Do you anticipate there's going to be legal action over this, though? I mean, is it all resolved yet?
The legal action is going on right now. They have sued, and the case is ongoing, but we remain very confident in our position because we own all the intellectual property, and we're going to defend this to the hilt.
And yet you did work very closely with TechCrunch. I mean, you were actually, there were people from Fusion Garage working in TechCrunch's offices, weren't there?
We were doing due diligence for an acquisition discussion. We were not working with TechCrunch on the device. It's completely different. It was an acquisition discussion that went wrong. They did not keep their promises, and we couldn't agree on terms, and we decided that we should move on and launch the product.
Okay, so tell us about the product, because as I say, the iPad launch, the iPad announcement, and then launch very much overshadowed the appearance of the Juju.
We are flattered that they decided to launch around the same time. The approach is completely different. We are taking a very web-centric approach, providing an open environment where the full web experience could be enjoyed. While they are taking an approach which is a closed garden, it's a walled garden with a closed ecosystem that is app-driven. So it's a completely different approach, and we are a 14-man company based out of Singapore. We're definitely not competing with Apple. The market is big enough for more than one player, and we are very confident in the approach we've taken because the internet has evolved to be the primary medium in which we compute today.
You said earlier that it runs Flash, which of course the Apple iPad does not do. How are you implementing that? Because my understanding was that Flash and Linux didn't mix well.
Yeah, we've done a lot of work to that front. We are working with Adobe in trying to optimize the experience further. But Flash does work on Linux, and we have done a lot of work on our behalf to make sure that this works the way it should. So we support the web in its complete form without any compromise.
But it's quite a challenge for a company to come along and for its first product to be into a niche which has traditionally been one where companies have just run aground. Who are your backers, and what sort of volume do you think you can manufacture in?
Yeah, I just want to clarify that it was a niche market before because it was very expensive to buy a tablet. It didn't quite reflect what the consumer needs were. The form factor was great, but was not being used for the right purpose. We've taken a completely different approach. We have created a form factor that is meant for couch computing. You want to lay back on your couch, you want to carry it around, and have a form factor that's great for consuming the content that you love on the web. Fusion Garage might be a small company. We have raised two rounds of funding that gives us ample funding to continue R&D and continue development work in innovating more stuff with the operating system. But more importantly, one of our investors is a OEM in Southeast Asia by the name of CSL. They are an investor and a strategic partner. Their revenues are in excess of $300 million US. And they have partnered with us to invest in the company as well as to help us pay for all upfront manufacturing, which eliminates all upfront costs associated with a company engaging in a hardware business. Mm-hmm. And we then pay them a small fee for helping us eliminate the manufacturing costs.
Okay, but at £319 for this, that's the retail price. I mean, that suggests a wholesale price of £120. I would have thought there's more than £120 worth of just materials alone in this. How can you make a profit on it?
We're definitely making a profit on this, and the cost components are very much optimized internally, and the device is definitely a profitable venture for us.
Cybercrime, Everything from identity theft to cyber war is the subject of Fatal System Error, a new book by Joseph Menn of the Financial Times. It's about hacking, cybersecurity, and what happens when your details get lost in cyberspace. Charles Arthur spoke with him about the book, our vulnerabilities, and how we can protect ourselves. And he began by asking what inspired Menn to write it.
Well, I've been covering cybercrime for about a decade at the LA Times, my former employer. And it was getting increasingly professionalized, increasingly commercialized. It was this entire underground industry. I knew it was getting increasingly important, but it was very hard to explain what was going on, and it seemed that it really merited a full book. In any case, back in 2003 and 2004, which is really the watershed, that's when the viruses stopped being something that teenagers were writing in their basements and started being something that organized crime was using to develop and capture fleets of personal computers in these conglomerations called botnets, which were used initially just for delivering spam, and then for what are called denial of service attacks.
You came across a guy called Barrett Lyon, who was one of the first people to set up a company that would basically protect sites against distributed denial of service attacks.
That's right.
What sort of led you to him, and what made him different from other cybersecurity people?
Denial of service attacks are something that pretty much anybody can understand. I mean, all these random computers ping a website and until it goes down. And in late 2003 and 2004, these gangs were basically extortionists. Were just knocking over all these websites and demanding $30,000, $40,000 be sent to a list of names in Latvia, or else their website wouldn't come back. Quite reasonably picked offshore gambling firms as their initial targets. And Barrett was hired. He's from originally from the Lake Tahoe area of California, and he was hired to protect these firms. And he did that. He beefed up their infrastructure. He wrote some pretty good code for weeding out the malicious traffic. But then he went above and beyond the call of duty and infiltrated the chat rooms of the bad guys. He traced back where the robot computers were getting their orders from, and it was from an internet relay chat channel in Kazakhstan. And I expected him to be, a boring guy at a big security company with a fleet of PR people around him and keeping him from saying anything interesting. But he came to my office and he was wearing shorts and flip-flops, and he said, "Yeah, I found out something about the bad guys." And I said, "Really, did you ever find out where they were?" And he said, "Yeah, actually, I chatted with them." I said, "You did?" And he didn't keep any transcripts of those chats. And he said, "Oh, yeah, here they are." And I said, "Well, you probably law enforcement wasn't very interested, right, because it's pretty hopeless." And he said, "No, actually, the FBI and the UK National High-Tech Crime Unit and the Russian MBD are all pretty interested." And it just kept getting better and better.
Some of the sites that he was protecting, it's a bit hard in some ways to tell who was, between the Russian gangsters and the offshore gambling gangsters, I guess you would say, which one is actually in the, which one is the one that needs protecting from whom?
Barrett's a very interesting guy. He's extremely smart technologically, and he's quite brave, but he had kind of tunnel vision, and he sort of missed the fact that the people that were funding him might be bad guys themselves. He learned more than he wanted to about the people that were sponsoring him. And, probably it would have dawned on you or I a little bit earlier, but, by the third time he had to meet payroll by going to a parking lot and picking up a manila envelope stuffed with cash, he thought, maybe I shouldn't be taking these guys' money, particularly to fight what is essentially yesterday's battle. So he went back to the FBI and said, "You might want to take a look at some of my funders." He told me about this off the record at the time, and I said, "Let me get this straight. You deliberately infiltrated the Russian cyber mafia, and you accidentally infiltrated the American cyber mafia. Okay, if this isn't a book, I really don't know what a book is."
The trail that you then follow takes you to Russia and to some of the satellite states of Russia, and it's there that the book sort of seems to explode in terms of the possibilities and the number of people who seem to be involved. There's Andy Crocker, who is from the National High-Tech Crime Unit in the UK, and it's interesting in passing that the UK seems to come out quite strongly in this as trying to control high-tech crime of this sort.
Barrett is sort of the hero of the first half of the book, and Andy is the hero of the second half of the book. This was one case where you had a combination of an extremely motivated private security expert in Barrett, and then you happened to have hit, he happened to connect with a country in Britain that was doing the right thing. Unfortunately, that is no longer the case. The National High-Tech Crime Unit has been absorbed into SOCA, the Serious Organized Crime Agency, and that's been a bit of a disaster for high-tech prosecutions. But for a while there, for a good 5 years, the British NHTCU was as good as it got anywhere in the world, and they would go wherever they had to and do whatever it took. And they sent agents to meet with Barrett, and they sent Andy Crocker to basically live in Russia for 3 to 4 years. And in the first 6 months, he got pretty much nowhere. And then Jack Straw, then the foreign secretary, he was over in Moscow to meet with his opposite number and said, "We want help on this gang of cyber extortionists." And, you know, the relations were then not so bad between the UK and Russia. And they said, "Okay, okay." And they finally paired Andy with somebody good at the MVD, and they went and they got these guys. Andy was nearly killed in the process when he made the mistake of trying to arrest the son of a powerful police chief. But they wound up getting three guys in jail and convicted. The unfortunate part is that when he tried to go upstream and get the people higher up in the criminal hierarchy, he ran into various flavors of corruption and official protection. One of the worst examples is a gentleman named King Arthur, who was by this point wanted in 5 or 6 countries. His friends in the MPD said, "Look, the FSB, which is the spy agency that effectively runs Russia, they know where he is, and they're not interested in arresting him right now."
People like to think that there's a sort of happy ending, that things are improving, that the good guys win in the end. In this tale, is there a happy ending? Are the number of computers that are being compromised falling? Is antivirus doing a better job? Are police doing a better job in terms of arresting the bad guys?
The overall picture is bleak, but there's some good news. The overall picture is that cybercrime is completely out of control. It's getting rapidly worse. Even small businesses are getting hacked routinely now by these Eastern European gangs. Some are actually being pushed into bankruptcy. So on that front, things are looking very, very bad, and in fact, people should not be, in my opinion, doing anything financial online if they can possibly help it. That's the bad news. The good news is that awareness is way up. I have to give a lot of credit to Google for coming forward and admitting that it was hacked in China. It elevated the debate from a bunch of IT guys trying to get their CEOs to spend more money on security to, a major public debate about foreign policy, which is where this belongs. There needs to be a massive coordinated effort. I believe that TCP/IP, the Fundamental Internet Protocol, we need to come up with a something that will serve alongside that is more secure, because the Internet is being used for way more than it was designed for, and I personally don't think it's fixable, and neither do Barrett or Andy.
Guardian technology editor Charles Arthur and author Joseph Menn. You can buy Joseph's book, Fatal System Error, on Guardian Books. Find out all you dare to know about online crime at guardian.co.uk/technology. That's all for this week. Many thanks to our studio guests, Matthew McGregor and Jemima Kish, and to Charles Arthur. Our producer this week was Scott Cawley. I'm Alex Kratosky. There are many ways to keep in touch with us, including our Twitter feed, GuardianTW, where you've been feeding back on last week's election campaign special. You can also find us on Facebook and do comment on the blogs. All the details are at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.